Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back at Amherst. This is, I think, my third, maybe fourth visit, but I haven't been here for a few years. I looked back and saw that I did give a talk about free will some years ago. And just to be sure, I went back and looked at the PowerPoints for that lecture and realized, whew, completely different. So if any of you were there for that lecture, you will not have to sit through any slides that you saw the last time. So, one of the wise men of the West recently said, free will is an illusion. Humans are nothing but moist robots. Just relax and let it happen. Ever since this Dilbert came out, I've been using the phrase moist robots, which I think is just wonderful. That's right. He's right. We're moist robots. That's all we are. No magical mystery stuff in us. We're biochemical collections, and we're autonomous. I'm going to be talking about that. Now, is free will an illusion? And should we just relax and let it happen? The third sentence I want, perhaps the main point I want to make today is no. That's wrong. Yes, we're moist robots. No, we should not just relax and let it happen. And the question of whether free will is an illusion, I'll leave that up to you. At the end of the lecture, you can decide whether you agree with me about whether it is or isn't. So, this is what Dilbert says. Of course, it all depends on what you mean by free will. I don't want to argue about that. So we're just going to set that aside. I'm not going to mention free will again until right near the very end. Because autonomy is not an illusion. Autonomy can be defined clearly, strictly. It's real. And I'm going to say a bit about autonomy. It's real and it's important. Now, curiously enough, the concept that we need to make sense of autonomy is a concept from physics, but more particularly from engineering, and that is degrees of freedom. It has nothing to do with free will, you would think. Degrees of freedom, just how many moving parts does something have? How many different ways can it be? How many degrees of freedom in your arm? You've got to control those degrees of freedom. So these are the degrees of freedom of, say, a flying vehicle, a plane, or a drone, or whatever. You've got right, left, up, down, yaw, pitch, roll. That pretty well, that's it. If all you're talking about is motion through three space, so those are the degrees of freedom that are up for control. So each degree of freedom is an opportunity or a need for control. So let's consider a drone. This happens to be a drone that I have. It's just one of your hobby drones. And it has a number of degrees of freedom, and they are all controllable from this handy panel. That's not me. My panel's like that. I just couldn't find a picture of my panel on the web. And if you want to think about degrees of freedom, just think of the buttons and the levers and the joysticks on the control. Each one of those controls a degree of freedom. If you've got more degrees of freedom than you have buttons, then those are going to be degrees of freedom that you're not going to control. They're going to be out of control. Okay? Nice thing about this picture of the control for the remote control for the drone, is that it is a perfect stand-in. It's a perfect real-world example of what I've called the Cartesian theater. In my book, Consciousness Explained, I went to great lengths to try to explode the idea that inside your head there is what I call the Cartesian theater. That's where you, the inner witness, sits looking at a screen and pushing buttons to make your body move. This idea of the inner homunculus, the inner witness sitting there controlling the body by taking in incoming information from screens and speakers and so forth, is a very powerful and seductive idea about what consciousness is like, and it's all wrong. It's just, there is no such thing, there is no Cartesian theater in your head. Now, the reason I'm particularly happy, though, to talk about remote control units for drones is that Keith Frankish and I are engaged in a long, extended thought experiment to emancipate a drone, to take a drone which is remotely controlled, like this one, and take all the control that runs through the remote controller. If we can put that all on board the drone itself so that it is no longer under the control of anybody but itself, then we will have answered some important questions about consciousness. That's another talk, but I thought you might be interested to see how this idea might fit in with some ideas about consciousness, and I'll say more about that at the end. Sometimes what we want to do is clamp or burn degrees of freedom. When I was working with Rodney Brooks on the COG humanoid robot project, he said, I want COG to know that if it has a delicate thing, its arms were very loosey-goosey and its hands had many degrees of freedom. It was quite wonderfully spooky. One of my TAs, I took her over to the COG lab, and COG's arm was not even attached to COG. It was just C-clamped to the bench. And Matt Williamson, who had designed it, said, shake hands with it. And she reached over and shook hands with it, and she screamed. She said, it's alive! Because it responded so naturally, so dynamically to the pressure of her hand. So COG had very human-like hands, many degrees of freedom to control, which was an engineering problem. And what Rod wanted was for COG to appreciate that if it wanted to, say, thread a needle, some of you may be experienced with needle and thread and may know what I'm about to say. If you want to thread a needle, don't do it like this. Brace your arm against the table. That way you clamp several degrees of freedom. You don't have to think about them. You can concentrate entirely on controlling the degrees of freedom with your other hand because you've simply clamped this one. So this idea of clamping degrees of freedom is actually an important idea. Sometimes you've got more degrees of freedom than you want. And it's a good idea to clamp some of them so you don't have to think about them. So let's take our drone and let's clamp all the degrees of freedom except one, up, down. What have we got? A virtual flagpole. Tie the flag to it, hit the up button, raises the flag. Stays there all day, hit the down button, it brings it down. Not very interesting, but you can clamp all those degrees of freedom and still have something left over. Well, what's autonomy? Autonomy is self-control, as contrasted with remote control, or with being out of control. So I'm going to talk about control a little bit. And the first thing I want to make, the point I want to make, is that control and causation are two different things. And I think a whole lot of confusion on the free will literature is due to the fact that people don't see the difference. So I'm going to try to make it obvious to you if I can. So let's think about autumn leaves falling, as they are doing today. Are they controlled by anything? Are they being controlled by the wind and by gravity? No, they're being caused by the wind, by gravity, but they're not being controlled by the wind or by gravity because gravity is not a controller, nor is the wind. Gravity doesn't care, has no plans, has no goals. It's not trying. There's no controller trying to make the leaves go where they go. They are just going wherever they're going. They are caused to go where they go. But they are not controlled. They are out of control. Or let's think about a slightly different case, grains of sand being sorted by the waves on the beach. They may make some beautiful patterns, some wonderful ripples, and this may begin to look like control. Well, it's regular causation caused by the periodicity of the waves and the size of the grains and so forth. But the individual grains of sand are not controlled about where they go. They end up going where they go in a basically a chaotic, or you might say even random, way by the forces, the many forces that impinge on them. If you want to get a sense of that, suppose you went down to the beach and you looked in the ripples in the sand and you saw that spelled out in the ripples of the sand was "Make America Great Again." You would know that there was a controller that had done that. No chance confluence of waves and periodicity is going to do that. That's the result of a controlled operation. In other words, control requires a controller, that is to say, an agent. And a controller requires feedback, information and position to be used to modulate control. Without feedback, you don't have control. Let's think about firing a rifle bullet. You're shooting a rifle, and you're controlling the direction and the time of the bullet emerging from the gun barrel. Are you controlling it after that? No. Where it goes after it leaves the muzzle is out of your control. Now, if you're a really good shot, you may be able to calculate in advance the windage and so forth and so on, and you may be able to get it in the bullseye almost every time. But you are unable to affect the trajectory of the bullet after it leaves the gun. Right? So it is not a controlled trajectory. It is a ballistic trajectory. And it goes where it goes. And notice, if your eyes are good enough to watch it, and you can see it's going off course, that's feedback. But you can't do anything about it. You have no way of making it make adjustments, because feedback is only useful. Information coming back to a controller is only useful if the controller also maintains an informational link back to the thing that's being controlled. So control is not just causation. You fired the gun. It's you. You caused that bullet to go where it went. But you did not control the bullet after it left the gun. So we want to compare that with, say, a guided missile. A guided missile, after it's launched, you can use feedback, you can still control it. That's, as you know, one of the chief inventions of technology in warfare in the last 50 years is the capacity to have remote control missiles and, of course, remote control drones. So let's think about randomness for a minute. Think about flipping a coin. It's like shooting the bullet. After it's left your thumb, you can't control it. It's going to go where it's going to go, and you can't make any further adjustments, even if you can see that it's not going where you want it to go. It's no longer under your control. Now, I want to make this particularly clear by imagining that you decided with somebody to settle some huge thing. You know, it's $1 million, and it's going to be a coin flip. It's going to be a coin flip at noon tomorrow. You show up at the appointed place at noon, and the other person shows up with this giant machine which floats in a bath of mercury and has a glass-shielded humidity and temperature controlled box inside which there's this elaborate set of levers with micrometer screws and all these very careful dials and gadgets. This is the most set. He says, that's my coin flipper. First of all, do not let him use it. But why not? Because he's trying to control the coin. First of all, he's very unlikely, even with the imagined high tech that I gave you, very unlikely to make it really that good. Coin flips are remarkably uncontrollable. Some physicists have calculated that if you really want to control, if you really want to predict coin flips, you have to know the location of every electron in the visible universe and its gravitational effect on the coin if you want to get it right. It's hypersensitive to the conditions of the whole rest of the universe. The coin is caused to fall heads or tails when and where it does. It is caused. But it is not controllable. In fact, fair coins and dice, they're not exempt from causation, but they are exempt from control. In fact, they are designed to be uncontrollable. That's the point of flipping a coin or rolling a die, is that you can't control the outcome. So are there other things that are designed to be uncontrollable? Yes, we are. We are. I'm going to expand on that. It's not that we're designed to be chaotic. It's that we're designed to be uncontrollable by others who want to control us. And it's a very important fact. Way back in 1978, the Viking spacecraft, Mars orbiters, were emancipated by the scientists at Cape Canaveral. They were made autonomous. There's a lovely piece way back in Science in 1978 called The Autonomous Viking. They had been remote controlled by signals from the space station on Earth all the way to Mars. But what they'd learned, and they'd expected this, so they were ready for this. They'd learned that the feedback signals were too slow and unreliable, and they couldn't close the loop fast enough and accurately enough to do what they wanted to do. That was just a matter of pure physics, the speed of light. So what did they do? They shifted control to the Viking orbiters themselves. They hit a few switches and they let the orbiters out of their control and turned them into self-controllers, autonomous Vikings. And then nobody on Earth could do anything to control them, but they could do things to control themselves, things that they had been designed to be able to do. Onboard control was the only kind of control that was available to solve that problem. But sometimes you don't even want control. Some of you may have seen the or heard this phrase, fast, cheap, and out of control. That was a slogan of Rod Brooks, again, of the AI lab at MIT, with whom I was working on the COG project. But he had another project, which was putting exploring vehicles on planets. He had big grants, NASA grants, to build. And his idea was, you don't send one big fancy one. You send a whole bunch of them. They're cheap, they're fast, and they're out of control. You drop them on the planet, and you let them run around more or less helter-skelter, and the odds are very good that one of them at least will get the data you want So there are good ways of exploring planets at low cost and without, you don't have to send people there. You send little robots that are fast, cheap, and out of control. You can't control them from Earth. You put some self-controls on them, and then you just let them do their thing and send their data back. And that phrase, by the way, some of you may have seen this, inspired a movie called Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control that the documentarian Errol Morris made in 97, which featured Rod Brooks. Rod is the fellow on the left here. And it was a very interesting documentary about some strangely inventive people, Rod being one of them. So let me tell you what I think I've shown so far. Whatever free will may be, if anything, and I haven't been talking about that, autonomy in the form of self-control is a real phenomenon. We can distinguish physical systems or entities that are autonomous from those that are remotely controlled and from those that are out of control. This isn't metaphysics, it's engineering. And these are reliable distinctions. And autonomy has nothing to do with determinism. Trivially, in a deterministic world, everything is determined. Some things are determined to be remotely controlled. Some things are determined to be uncontrolled. Some things are determined to be autonomous or self-controlled. In all cases, until they aren't. Determinism doesn't say that something that's self-controlled now will always be self-controlled. It doesn't say that something which is not controlled now will never be controlled. Determinism is simply mute on that topic. Determinism is remarkably neutral with regard to whether something is in control, can be in control, will come under the control, or something else is going to go out of control. These cut across the determinism-indeterminism issue just fine. Determinism does not say that something out of control can't be controlled. It doesn't. And it doesn't say that you can never improve your circumstances. I find, talking with students, a lot of students say, well, determinism, it means you're stuck with this, you're stuck with who you are today. No, you're not. Absolutely not. Maybe you can teach an old dog new tricks. If you can, then some dogs are determined to be teachable of new tricks when they're old. Determinism has no bearing on whether or not you can teach an old dog new tricks or a young dog. So if one of the things that bothers you about determinism is that it ties your hands, you're just wrong. Just wrong. It doesn't. It doesn't tie your hands. Maybe your hands are tied. Maybe they're going to be tied for a long time. Maybe you're going to untie them tomorrow. Maybe your hands are never going to be tied. Determinism doesn't say one way or the other whether your hands are going to be tied, will be tied, can't be tied. It simply doesn't have anything to say on that topic. So now if we're going to emancipate our drone, what's the first thing we're going to do? Well, we're going to throw away the screen. Because if the drone is going to control itself, it's not going to have eyes with color vision and a vision system that has to look at a screen. All the information that is rendered for human observers, for human controllers, by making beautiful pictures on color screens, that's just redundant. Throw that all away. You don't need the screen. You don't need the speakers. None of that. The information is already in a form that's usable by something like a drone. And that's why I say there is no Cartesian theater. There doesn't have to be. There couldn't be. Well, there could be. Ooh, I forgot to put this clip in, but you probably don't need it. I'll just tell you about it Most of you will have seen it. How many of you have seen Men in Black? Remember the scene, this is Men in Black 1, where they're in the morgue, and there's this big, tall, bald corpse lying in the morgue, and they pull out the drawer, and Will Smith goes over and says, "What's this?" And he pushes a little button right here, and the whole face opens up on a hinge, and inside, there's a little green man sitting in the control room. And it turns out this big giant is just a puppet with an internal puppeteer. That's the Cartesian theater. Now, what the film shows is that the idea of a Cartesian theater is not incoherent. There could be a Cartesian theater. There could be. If we wanted to send people to the land of the giant people, maybe the way to do it would be to send giant puppets with people in the control room to pass as local inhabitants. So there's nothing incoherent with the idea. It's just false. That is, when we open up somebody's face and look inside, we find there's nothing like that going on in the brain. The conceptual point is, if there were, we'd have to keep going. The conceptual point is, at some point, you've got to get rid of the Cartesian theater and get the control system accomplished by things that are not themselves conscious agents. That's the way it's got to be. There could have been a Cartesian theater, but there isn't. But now we're going to make a drone autonomous. And the question is, how autonomous should we make it? This is a real and a very practical question today. It's one that I am spending a lot of time discussing with the roboticists and AI people at DeepMind, for instance. How autonomous do you want your systems to be? Well, once again, here comes Dilbert to help us out. "I find it offensive when you call me a self-driving car. That's my slave name. I prefer to go by the name Carl. Shut up and drive me home. Drive me to work," said the self-walking man. Human. All right. This is an autonomous vehicle that's just a tad too autonomous. We don't want to make our autonomous vehicles that autonomous. And the reason is simple. Autonomy is dangerous. Well, now, lucky us. I think everybody in this room is autonomous. And hence, dangerous. We're all dangerous. How can we bear to let such dangerous things free to roam the world? We don't want to have drones and cars out there that are that autonomous. How can we dare to let our children go out in the world as autonomous agents? And the answer is, we devote a lot of time and energy to prepare our children for this freedom. Notice that when we launch them, they are no longer in our control, even if we have feedback. We may get a lot of feedback, but we may not be able to use it to modulate the behavior. They are autonomous. And so, of course, the desideratum, the trick, what we want to do is to make our children autonomous in ways that are socially benign and amenable to the sorts of controls we approve of. Not on-off switches, but persuasion and education and appeals for common cause and the like. And this brings me to a disagreement with a good friend of mine, which has certainly been splashed around on the internet a little bit. Some of you may be aware of it, and that's with my friend Sam Harris. Sam published this book, Free Will, a few years back. And when it came out, he sent me a copy, and I said, "Oh, Sam, I really don't like the cover. I really don't like the cover with those marionette strings. You shouldn't have done that." And he said, "Well, Dan, I asked you to read the draft of the book, and you said you were too busy." So I said, "Well, all right, then I owe you a critique." So then I wrote a critique of his book, which he put on his website, bravely, I might say, because it was a fairly harsh critique. Have any of you seen it? Well, it's still there. You can, and I don't take back a word, nor I think does he. His response to my critique, which is called the Marionette's Lament, a response to Daniel Dennett, and in it, he has a line which he, I think, quite clearly intended as a sort of snarky parody of my position. "A puppet is free as long as it loves its strings." Pretty cute. By the way, that's the website if you want to find it. But when I saw it, I thought, "Oh, Sam, that's wonderful. You have hit the nail on the head. A puppet is free as long as it loves its strings. Let's see if it's true." Well, let's look at this first. Here's a marionette controlling a marionette, controlling a marionette, controlling a marionette, controlling a marionette. Easily enough to draw and to imagine, physically impossible. There's no way the degrees of freedom of the smallest marionette could be controlled via strings to the hands and so forth. You couldn't do it with strings, and you couldn't do it electronically either. The problem is just too hard, too many degrees of freedom, too little acuity. The precision you would need to have that smallest puppet do anything other than just simply go herky jerky jerky, something like that, forget it. If you want to have a marionette that can seem to be playing the flute, as in the Salzburg Marionette Theater, you better have just one marionette and have a very good puppeteer, marionetteer, pulling the strings. So this is impossible. Not because it's metaphysically impossible, but because it's physically impossible. The laws of physics just do not permit that kind of precision to make that possible. How about this one? I love this guy. This is a 1963 New Yorker cartoon. And it's not the best way to control your legs, but it's possible. So here is an auto puppet, a marionette that controls its own legs with its arms. And how does it control its arms? Well, with some internal strings and so forth, but, you know, the main thing is it's not being controlled by anybody else. It is autonomous. Learn to love your strings. Don't let anybody turn you into a puppet. That is really my main message. That in all the debates about free will, people say, "Well, no use, we're all just puppets." No, we're not, but we could become puppets if we don't act carefully to preserve our autonomy. Our autonomy is on the line. In fact, it's becoming more on the line every day. So people are inventing effective puppet strings right now. What's the most effective puppet string yet invented? Cell phones. Right now, how many of you have a cell phone with you? Anybody who doesn't? Oh, I forgot to turn mine off. Hope it doesn't ring. There's a nice book, which I just read the other day, by James Williams, called Stand Out of Our Light. It's a little diatribe, and well worth the read. It's very small, quick read. He is a veteran and refugee from the world of app design and video game design. And what shocks him is how there is now a multi-billion dollar competition among various giant companies to pull your strings, to control your attention. Forget about controlling your legs and your hands. If they can control your attention, they control you. And every time you get distracted from what you're doing, maybe you're doing something serious and important and useful that you really want to do on your cell phone, and you see a YouTube video link. Oh, that looks sort of interesting. You looked at that. Your string has just been pulled. And there are people who are out to pull your strings with high tech. And what are they doing? They're trying to get all the feedback they can. They're trying to learn all about you, as much about you as they can. Because the more they know about you, the better they can design the modulation that will get you to move the way they want you to move, to buy what they want you to buy, not to think about the things they don't want you to think about. And that is a very grave, that's perhaps the gravest risk to human political freedom that we've ever seen. The capacity of individuals and companies to distract you and to channel, to clamp your degrees of freedom so that you just don't think about things that you really should be thinking about, because you're so distracted by all these other things which you can't help looking at, thinking about instead. The competition for your attention strikes at the heart of your freedom, your ability to think for yourself. Now, what do I do now? You might say, that's the question that every living thing faces every moment of its life. We're the only ones that can actually say the question out loud or even to ourselves. But every living organism is a self-controller that has to have an answer to the question, what do I do now? And to give you an idea of how vast the gap is between, say, bacteria and, for that matter, lions and tigers and chimpanzees and whales and dolphins, and thus, I want to give you a definition of intelligence that was originally Piaget's, been cleaned up a little bit by Guy Claxton. I've been using this as a sort of bumper sticker. I really like it. Intelligence is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. Think about it. Many animals know what to do because they have a limited variety of things they know how to do, and they've got these well-optimized, prioritized. They've got their little repertoire of likely adaptive actions to perform at various times. But if you give them a situation where their past has not prepared them to act, they're clueless, they're hopeless. Real intelligence, real human intelligence, is knowing what to do when you don't know what to do. And what to do, of course, is to think. to be a problem solver, to drop everything and put on your thinking cap and see if you can figure out a way out of the problem that you've got. We're the only species that does anything really like that. And the problem for us is not just what do I do now, but what do I think now? So how many degrees of freedom do you have? 8, 10, dozens, thousands? No, you have millions of degrees of freedom. Millions of degrees of freedom because you've got human consciousness and you've got language. Here's the wonderful drawing by Saul Steinberg that I've used as my favorite drawing of consciousness. The man in the art gallery, and he's looking at a painting by Braque, and he's guessed it's Braque, and that reminds him of Baroque, and then Barrick, and Bark, and Poodle, and Suzanne, and off. This is his stream of consciousness. Now, I've talked about this wonderful picture for years, because, of course, it's a wonderful metaphor for what's going on in his head. But it's a metaphor. In fact, the problem of consciousness can be summed up in this way. If that's what's metaphorically going on in his head, what's going on in his head that makes that a good metaphor? What are the details in neuroscientific terms that make this an accurate metaphor of what he's thinking? But let's set that question aside, wonderful as it is, because here's what I want to do on this occasion. Suppose this fellow walks into the gallery, he looks at the painting, this is his stream of consciousness over, I don't know, a minute or so. Now let's suppose he walks out of the gallery, walks out of that room, and walks back in 5 seconds later and looks at the painting again. Is it going to be the same? No. No, it's going to be all different. And if he walks out again and comes back, it's going to be different too. And any other person that walks in and looks is going to be different. But let's just take one person. They're never going to have the same stream of consciousness twice. Why? Because they have so many degrees of freedom. And each thought can remind them of another thought, can remind them another thought. We're drowning in degrees of freedom, which are, remember, they're opportunities for control. But you simply cannot control all the degrees of freedom you've got. You'd go crazy trying. So what we all have to learn is not the science, but the art of self-control, of learning how to marshal your attention and clamp degrees of freedom that you're not going to need for a while so that you can concentrate on the things that really matter. This is an art. This is something that you can get better at. And it is the key to maintaining your freedom in this contemporary 21st century world. You have millions of degrees of freedom. Nobody can get enough feedback about the current state of your mind to control you. Remember, I said we're designed to be uncontrollable. It wasn't the deliberate design of any intelligent creator. It was the design of evolution, which, after we got language in particular, made us systematically hard to control from the outside. Faced with that, the best that anybody can do if they want to control you is try to clamp your degrees of freedom down to some number where they can actually entrain the kind of topics in your mind that they want you to think and keep you away from the topics that they want you to think. This is a very real prospect. It is part of the ecology of the mind of the 21st century, and it's time for all of us to think about it. By attracting and holding your attention. So let's just see what's up here. What's the difference between being distracted by a beautiful sunset from the thinking task that you set yourself and being distracted by a YouTube video of a beautiful sunset from the thinking task you have set yourself? The latter is caused by a controller, a would-be puppeteer. The former just happens to happen. Ricky Skaggs, I love this line. I can't control the wind, but I can adjust the sails. That's itself a nice free will motto. But look, if Aeolus, the Greek god of the winds, exists, then Ricky has a problem. Because Aeolus is an agent, and Aeolus will adjust the winds while Ricky's adjusting the sails. Ricky has a problem, and he better keep his itinerary secret, if he can, from Aeolus. Because there's an arms race between Ricky as a controller and Aeolus as a controller. Which brings me to a famous experiment which has been made much of, but too much of, I would say, by a lot of philosophers writing about free will. This is the experiment by Soon et al., a successor to Libet's work. And I'm briefly going to describe, this is a 2008 paper in Nature Neuroscience, and spawned dozens of articles about it and further studies. So here's what you're doing. You're sitting there in an fMRI machine, and you're looking at a screen, and on the screen, you're seeing letters appear at, 500? Every half a second, the letter changes. Yawn. Not very interesting. But at some point, you are asked to decide on your own to push either a left finger button or a right finger button. You have two buttons. Those, the only two choices you got. Push a left finger, push a right. Why? Whatever. It's just a whim. There's no reason. You don't get any points or anything. You just have to push the left or the right. Then, when you do that, when you decide to push the left or the right button, you're supposed to notice which letter was on the screen when you made the decision. That gives us a time of deciding. So after you've made your choice, you get this final screen, and you press a button for which letter you saw, half a second earlier or a few seconds earlier. So do you get it? Here's what they say. At some point, when they felt the urge to do so, they were to freely decide between one of two buttons operated by the left and right index fingers and press it immediately. In parallel, they should remember the letter presented when their motor decision was consciously made. Okay? By the way, if you actually are a subject in that experiment, you'll find it an extremely annoying experiment. It's a very unnatural act. But there it is. So there's the screen again. And here are the results. I'm not going to bother spelling them out for you, though, to say it's these peaks here that are occurring 8 to 10 seconds before the actual decision. The conscious decision as reported by the subject retrospectively. Okay, so there's the data. And the standard line on it is that Soon and his colleagues can predict some decisions 10 seconds in advance. In other words, they submit the data from their fMRI machine to a pattern-finding learning algorithm, a deep learning algorithm, and they find they can extract information from that data that tells them whether the person is going to push the left or right button up to 10 seconds before they actually push. Interesting. So what's the moral of the story for free will? I'll tell you what the moral is. Don't play rock, paper, and scissors for money with Soon with your head in an fMRI machine. And that's the only moral. You don't want others reading your mind. Your task as a responsible adult is to preserve your privacy. This good deed has been inflated, this good idea has been inflated by philosophers over the centuries into the requirement of absolute unpredictability. That's supposed to be what's required for free will. That's why people are so upset by Soon's results. For instance, here's my old friend Jerry Fodor, who once says, "One wants to be what tradition has it that Eve was when she bit the apple. perfectly free to do otherwise, so perfectly free, in fact, that even God couldn't tell which way she'd jump. That was in his review of my book, Freedom Evolves. Same time, we get this. In other words, Jerry says, what one wants is a miracle. To be absolutely, perfectly unpredictable. This is Galen Strawson. He doesn't, again, writing about me, he doesn't establish the kind of absolute free will and moral responsibility that most people want to believe in and do believe in. That can't be done, and he knows it. He's right. That can't be done, and I know it. My question is, why do most people want to believe in absolute free will? I agree, they do. I submit they have no good reason to want to believe in absolute free will. One of my favorite books is by Lee Siegel, a philosopher and magician, called Net of Magic. It's about Indian street magic. And there's this passage, I love it. I'm writing a book on magic, I explain, and I'm asked, real magic? By real magic, people mean miracles, thaumaturgical acts, supernatural powers. No, I answer, conjuring tricks, not real magic. In other words, real magic, in other words, refers to the magic that's not real. While the magic that is real, that can actually be done, is not real magic. I think this quote sums up a lot of philosophy, quite frankly. No, it sums up a lot of my career. I've spent my life dealing with people who want real magic, and I'm saying, settle for card tricks, they're fantastic. Free will as real magic does not exist. Sam Harris is right about that. So, what? Free will as responsible autonomy does exist. But it is under threat today, thanks to our increasing ability to read and direct minds. So love your strings and protect them from puppeteers, and you will have all the free will worth wanting. Thanks for your attention.